Today on the 21st, Alex Kotlowitz has been writing about violence in Chicago for decades, in film and print, and for This American Life. His latest book is called An American Summer, and it follows people for whom gun violence has become a part of daily life.
So many of them were trying to keep the violence from, well, it had clearly shaped a part of their lives to keep it from defining them.
Plus, Oregon has America's last blockbuster store, and so far it's surviving even the pandemic. But there are still plenty of family video brand stores right here in Illinois. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with some of the people behind the last video stores in Illinois. But first, Chicago is having a bad year for violence. Through June 28th, the Chicago Police Department is reporting 324 murders. That's a significant increase over last year, up 34%. But it is about where the city was in 2016 and 2017. Beyond that, there have been more than 1,300 shootings, and a number of recent victims have been children.
Developing now, a 3-year-old girl is recovering after being shot in the chest last night in West Englewood.
By our count, she's one of at least 8 children aged 10 or under who have been shot in the last 2 weeks.
Among the more than a dozen murder victims over the weekend, 10-year-old Lena Nunez, she was watching TV Saturday night in Logan Square, struck and killed by a stray bullet.
Dear God, and dear Chicago, we have to do better than what we're seeing.
This is not just a problem for Englewood or Humboldt Park or any other neighborhood plagued by gun violence.
Given these events, we thought it would be a good opportunity to revisit my conversation with Alex Kotlowitz. For decades, the Chicago-based journalist has tried to go deeper on these issues by sharing the stories of people who live with that sort of violence every day. You might know his 1992 book, There Are No Children Here, his documentary, The Interrupters, or his many segments on public radio's This American Life. His most recent book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It traces many different ways people's lives can be touched by gun violence. The book came out in paperback in March. I spoke to Kotlowitz last year when it was first released. Alex Kotlowitz, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
So when did you first start thinking about shootings and gun violence and really the human stories behind them?
Right. So, you know, my first exposure to it was working on my first book, There Are No Children Here, which, you know, where I follow two young boys living in a public housing complex. And to this day, I remember the very first day I met Lafayette, the older of the two boys, and he was this 12-year-old kid at the time, didn't have much affect, not much emotion, and it was my first time in the projects, and I was just sort of kind of mortified by the conditions there. And I remember sitting in his apartment, and he was telling me about a older boy, a teenager who had been shot and killed just a week earlier and apparently died on the stairwell outside their first floor apartment. And I remember he told me this without much affect, and to be perfectly honest, I sat there not fully believing him. And I remember Lafayette must have sensed that because he yanked me by my elbow and took me out to the stairs to show me the bloodstains on the steps. And that was my sort of the first moment that I sort of realized how the violence had so permeated so many communities in the city. And then it was so much a part of the 2 years that I spent with them.
Yeah, and then you've continued to sort of follow, I mean, not only their stories and keep in touch with them, but, I mean, you've expanded your work to talk to so many other people. So let's start talking about this book in particular, right? You focus on the stories of individual people. There's kind of this through line of the summer 2013, although not all of the violence happens in 2013. But what are some of the things that the stories you tell in this book have in common?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I chose this summer. I mean, it was a fairly random summer, and I really needed some kind of scaffolding this because for this book because I knew that I, in order to capture the breadth of the experiences, I needed to tell a number of stories. So as you say, there are 14 stories in this book, some of which course through the entire summer, some of which are self-contained. I mean, the thing that for me was really clear when I sat down to write, I mean, it was after I'd done all the reporting, is that they were all, for almost all stories about people who were emerging from the violence and trying to reckon with it, and that they were still standing in this world that was slumping around them, and some of them, well, all of them moving forward, and some of them moving forward forcefully, if not heroically. So there was that. I found, you know, so many of the stories, in some manner or another, people grappled with the notion of forgiveness. People sort of grappled with the fact that they held on tightly to the violence that had come to shape them, and that it was hard for them to, they were still trying to make sense of it. And then the other part of it is that so many of them were trying to keep the violence from, well, it had clearly shaped a part of their lives, to keep it from defining them.
And it's not just people who either perpetrated gun violence or, you know, had a direct relative or a friend of theirs who was killed. There were people who were trying to just escape from the neighborhood. I mean, it's stunning in a way how far the tentacles spread of these shootings.
Right, right. Though I think each of the people in the book, if I'm not mistaken, I think each of them in some ways was directly touched by an act of violence. You know, it may have been a friend, a family member, or as you mentioned, there's, you know, a couple of people who actually had committed acts of violence. So it's hard to grow up in many of the communities, these communities I write about in Chicago, and not be somehow directly affected. And my feeling is, and the reason why I wrote the book, is that we've completely underestimated the impact of the violence on both the spirit of individuals and the spirit of community.
Yeah, and one chapter that really has stuck with me is the one on Ari Sanders and Ashara Muhammad, and I wanted to ask you about that. You know, to the extent that most, many people at least, hear about a shooting, it's, you know, a brief in a newspaper or a tweet with the Chicago Scanner hashtag or something like that, but there's obviously so much more to the story, and you open this chapter with a short Tribune report about a postal worker charged in the fatal shooting of a teenager. So how did you first hear about Ari Sanders?
Yeah, I heard about it through the newspaper and ended up contacting a lawyer for... There were two brothers, Aries and his older brother, who went to sell a gun, and apparently there was, you know, their account of it is that they, when they got there, it was clear that they were going to be robbed, and a gunfight ensued, and somebody was, Aries' older brother ended up killing someone. And Aries was, you know, what interested me initially was Aries is this really good young man, good-hearted young man. He was a postal worker. He was doing everything right, and he had an older brother who had been in and out of trouble with the law. And so I initially had this idea that I was going to write about these two brothers, and when I was talking with Aries, Aries had called a friend of his, Shara, it's not her real name, she asked me to use a different name, and who was a childhood friend, and said, you know, this writer's talking to me. Now, Shara, it turns out, knew who I was. In fact, it turns out we had actually spoken years back when she had called for some advice in her career. And she lives in Philadelphia, and I went to visit her, and I realized, well, this is really her story. You know, Ashara grew up in a single-parent household in South Side of Chicago, remarkable mother. She has a sister, and Ashara is this really bright, whip-smart young woman, and she had been disappointed with men in her life all along. Her father had left the family, and the men, you know, the boys she knew as they got older were getting into trouble, and so she kind of got as far away as she could. She went away to college, graduated, got an internship at NPR, and ended up living in Philadelphia.
Which turns out to be the NPR experience turned out to be kind of unpleasant for her, and shows her difficulty and kind of...
I wouldn't say it was a mixed bag. You know, Ashara felt that she felt there were times that she felt humiliated by gaps in her knowledge And she didn't feel well treated. In fact, it's funny, it was when she was at NPR that she had called me for some guidance. She had just read my first book. And I honestly don't remember the phone call, but she does. She's just this remarkable woman. But anyway, her best friend from childhood, Aries, ends up getting arrested on this murder charge, and they begin this, what is really a beautiful correspondence when Aries is in the county jail. And so much of this story revolves around that correspondence and this reconnection, and that brings Ashara back to Chicago. She doesn't come to live here, but it begins to get her to reckon with some of the young men that she grew up with, especially Aries. And it's really about this beautiful friendship, this beautiful connection that they have in the wake of this shooting.
And it seems to also be about, it becomes about Black identity, right? And somebody who wants to sort of leave that life behind, but finds that even when she moves across the country, it still finds a way to touch her.
Right, and she talks about too that so many of the men she knew kind of were wearing these masks and sometimes presented themselves in ways that really weren't true to who they were. And one of the things that's really touching about this exchange of letters is how open and vulnerable Aries is in his letters to Ashara.
Yeah, of course, and I don't know how much you want to spoil what happens. They do try to reconnect. It maybe doesn't have that storybook ending, though.
Right, right. Though they're still really dear friends. They have a complicated relationship, but they're still very, very close. But yeah, and I think it's one of the things that was really important for me for each of these stories I was looking for stories that in some ways surprised me, that knocked me off balance, and this was certainly one of them.
Did Eddie Bocanegra's story surprise you? I guess maybe
Eddie,
we can set it up by saying, who is Eddie Bocanegra? How does he spend his days today?
Yeah, Eddie also, too, is this other remarkable human being. Eddie, when he was 18, was a member of a Latin gang, and a friend of his in the gang was shot and paralyzed, and Eddie, in an act of vengeance, shoots and kills a rival gang member and ends up, is convicted and serves 14 years in prison. And Eddie's story is really a story about trying to forgive yourself for what you've done. Eddie's incredibly remorseful about that moment. And he's not asking for forgiveness from anybody else. He's just trying to ask forgiveness from himself. And he's devoted every moment in his adult life to trying to undo some of the damage that he was a part of. Both his brothers served time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and one of them came back with PTSD, and Eddie saw some of himself in his brother and just realized the kind of trauma that he had experienced. And so Eddie now runs this incredible program, Ready Chicago, that works with, not only tries to provide youth with jobs, but also has them undergo cognitive behavioral therapy, these group therapy sessions, to get them more self-aware about who they are, what they're experiencing, to make them in some ways feel less alone. It's one of the things that was really clear to me with all the people I spent time with, is this utter sense of loneliness that so many people have, that nobody could possibly understand what they've been through.
Yeah, and reading his story about the work he does in the community and the understanding that he has and that the people he works with have of how this affects everyday life, I was struck because I've seen Eddie Bocanegra around. My day job is reporting on state government. I've seen him around city and state policy discussions. And I wonder, what do you see as the disconnect between the way, you know, City Hall and the General Assembly here in Springfield talk about these issues and the way people experience it every day?
Right. Well, I think there's this notion that people somehow get accustomed or hardened or numb to the violence. And I think we, again, have completely underestimated the impact the violence has on individuals. That it really, you know, it gets in your bones. And that's what so many of these stories are about. I mean, there's one story in the book about an incident that happened 30 years ago that still deeply impacts the lives of the people involved. And so you meet somebody like Eddie, and Eddie's kind of a testament to the fact that people have second acts in life. I mean, the work he's doing, some of the most extraordinary work around violence prevention, not only in Chicago, but in the country.
Yeah. I wonder about, you also talk and you've written about that, you know, the idea of police solving more murders, right? This is just thinking of the policy responses that people talk about here, and we've only got about a minute before we have to take a break. But, you know, if do you, you you feel like if police could solve more murders, this is something that could, you know, help prevent future
closure,
violence.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, no, that's it. I would say if police can actually solve these crimes, they could, you know, this might prevent future violence.
Right, right. The clearance rate in violent crime in Chicago is remarkably low. You've got a 3 in 4 chance of getting away with murder and a 9 in 10 chance of getting away with shooting and wounding someone. And, the police, given the fact that the police have such a low clearance rate, there's a feeling in the community that there's no justice. And what that does, one of the things it does is it completely erodes the trust between these communities and the police. This inability to solve crimes, which is sort of such a fundamental task of a police department. If I were running the police department, it would be the absolute priority that somehow to get those clearance rates.
Yeah.
Raised up. And again, I think there's this kind of myth that people don't cooperate because of a no snitch culture, when in fact, so many people don't cooperate out of fear.
Yeah.
And this is kind of this vicious cycle. If you can't solve crimes, people are afraid.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear more from Alex Kotlowitz. Before we do take that break, though, I do want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We've been hearing interesting things from listeners. It's informed our coverage just this very week. You can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. More to come with Alex Kotlowitz after this short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're revisiting my conversation with Chicago writer, filmmaker, and journalist Alex Kotlowitz. Regular listeners to public radio might also remember hearing him on This American Life. His latest book is An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It came out in paperback this spring. I spoke to Kotlowitz last year. Now, Alex, one thing you've written about, and you even mentioned it, talking about your first experience reporting for what became your book, There Are No Children Here, about the public nature of Chicago's violence. And it comes through so much in this book, in your current book, An American Summer, that just people see this all the time, walking down the street, in alleys, on streets, in parks. Can you talk about the publicness of Chicago's violence and how that, you know, how that affects people?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that's changed from 28 years ago, of course, in the city, is that we've torn down all the public housing high rises, and the violence. Well, the violence was worse some 28 years ago. The numbers were even higher than they are now. It feels more intense now, and I think partly because the violence was taking place, it was in the projects, really out of sight, out of mind, and now with those projects down, they're happening in the neighborhoods. And, you know, most acts of violence in the city happen on the street or in an alley, in a park, I mean, these very public places. And so people are, you know, so it has a profound impact on the community as a whole. It's really hard to grow up in these neighborhoods and not be touched by it, not to have witnessed it or witnessed the after effects of an act of violence, just given its public nature.
I wonder, when you take into account the fact that the homicide clearance rate, as we were talking about, is so low, the violence is so public, is it rational for people to engage in retribution, you know, from their perspective, to carry a gun?
Right. Well, I don't know if it's rational, but you can understand why people, you know, might come to seek justice on their own. It's one of the concerns I think one should have if you have a low clearance rate, is that people don't have confidence then in the authorities and law enforcement. And so in the end, as you suggest, end up taking justice into their own hands. And that, you know, it should be a concern.
Yeah. So I want to take a step back, and you talked about how the public housing has largely been torn down for the most part in the city, but that's not the only change in the way violence happens. And we still hear the word thrown around gang violence. Here in Springfield, you even hear people saying gang bangers in reference to people. You know, how is the reality of that different from what people might expect or think or remember?
Right. No, it's a really good question, because it's changed considerably. When I was working on There Are No Children Here, you know, the gangs, the African-American gangs, were really highly organized, very hierarchical, and they were organized around this really robust drug trade. In fact, I remember when I was working on There Are No Children Here, when there was a dispute between the gangs and it was about to erupt into something more, you know, they'd come out and warn you, and so you had time to get into the building or into your apartment for safety. And so in the late 1990s, you know, there was a kind of policy decision made to go after the heads of the snake and basically arrest and put in prison the gang leaders, which they did. And as a result, the gangs just began to break apart. And so now, you know, the police estimate there are anywhere between 600 to 800 different factions in the city, cliques or crews, organized not around the drug trade, but just organized simply block by block. And so it's really hard not to be associated with a gang just by where you live.
Right. If you're a male of a certain age, you're going to be assumed almost, and you live on a certain block, you're of a certain age, you're going to be assumed to be clicked
right,
up,
and it
right?
provides you some modicum of protection. It's the other thing that was so apparent in so many of these stories I worked on is, you know, often when somebody's killed in the city, the first thing you read about is they're a gang member, or you read about their criminal record. And first of all, there's so much more to people than that. But it was also this notion, this kind of unspoken notion, that kind of what goes around comes around. And, you know, there are a couple of instances in the book where right after a family member has been murdered, especially with a parent, the first thing they do is they try to defend the honor of their child, which is just a kind of a horrible place to be in the wake of having just lost a son or a daughter.
Yeah, and they can't accept sometimes So I wonder, when you are talking to people, you're going into these communities, how do you chronicle this gun violence without, you know, reinforcing stereotypes that some people might have about the city and specifically its black residents?
Well, it's the challenge, I think, for any storyteller, is how to spend time in any community and not sort of fall into the usual tropes and stereotypes. And for me, I thought this book would be a 2-year project. It ended up being nearly 6 years. And one of the reasons was I just ended up spending so much time with the people in the book, and some of the stories that I was following kind of unfurled over time. But, you know, I try to sort of honor people for who they are, and to recognize that, you know, all of us are kind of rich, complicated, nuanced human beings. And the truth of the matter is there's very little good and evil in the world, and we all kind of fall somewhere in between. And so my challenge as a storyteller is to try to provide some sense of humanity to people who we think we know, but in fact we probably know very little. You know, that the beauty of storytelling, I think, and this is what I love about my work, because it, you know, I'm out in the world and I get my assumptions challenged all the time. I get knocked off balance, and then I hope to do that with my readers as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about the length of time you spend with people, and I've heard you, you know, talk about deadlines and taking years, and that gives me some hope as a reporter who's also struggles with deadlines.
I've never been good at deadlines. When I worked at the Wall Street Journal, it was my Achilles heel.
But I mean, you spend so much time on these stories, and one of the stories where you did spend a lot of time is in Harper High School for This American Life, and some of that story works its way also into An American Summer. But at one point, you talk with a student named Devante. We have a little tape here. And he's struggling with the guilt of accidentally shooting and killing his brother not long before you met him. And I'd like to play a clip of him. He's here talking with social workers at Harper High about how he's doing.
So what about sleeping and all of that, Devante? Are you sleeping okay?
Yeah.
What you do at night to help you, though?
To go to sleep? Mm-hmm. I take some NyQuil.
You still taking NyQuil?
Man, I take it on a regular basis. Because I need to go to sleep, man.
So we need to
I need to sleep tight.
Now, what happens if you don't take the NyQuil?
I don't go to sleep.
Can I ask you a question? What are the thoughts that you have when you get ready to go to sleep?
None.
You having some kind of thoughts that you're trying to escape, so that
I
way
I just be up thinking about stuff.
What one thought that you be thinking about?
The one my brother, I be thinking about a lot of stuff.
So I mean, he says he's thinking about his brother, and later on he tells you he wants to give up on life, and I wonder how you, as a reporter, as a human being, what do you do with that information in that moment?
Right. So, yeah, just to back up. So, you know, this is, you know, as you mentioned, this two-part series I worked on for This American Life with two other reporters, Linda Lutton and Ben Calhoun. And we kind of embedded ourselves at the high school for 6 months. They had just had a horrific year. They had lost 28 former and current students shot, seven of them killed the previous year. And so it was a school that was trying to right itself. And I was pretty lucky. I think I planted myself with these two social workers who you hear in that tape, Anita Stewart and Crystal Smith, these two incredible women. And they had a little office, and I would just hang out in that office, and the students would come through, and students like Devante, who I got to meet through Anita and Crystal. And so, yeah, Devante was, you know, what was kind of astonishing about that piece of tape we just heard is it's the first time he's really talked about this. And he's clearly still, you know, it's been a year, he's still clearly reeling from the death of his brother. And so you're right, he does at one point tell me that he sometimes wonders whether he's kind of worthy of living. And so in that case, I mean, I had a really good relationship with Anita and Crystal, and I felt it was really important that I just alert them what was going on. I think the thing that was kind of clear with Devante, it was clear with so many of the people I write about in the book, is for many of them, it's the first time they've ever spoken about this with anybody. And all these, they've got just all these feelings, emotions just kind of roiling inside. And again, there's this kind of utter sense of loneliness. I mean, Devante was really fortunate in that he had Anita and Crystal by his side.
How do you strike the balance? I mean, I you have so much compassion in your writing. I've got to imagine you feel like you want to help people. How do you draw that line? I'm here to tell a story. I'm not here to participate in your life, or
right,
even have that line
anymore.
Well,
it's hard, and to be honest, you know, it's especially hard because many of the people that I write about, not all, but many, you know, they become friends, they become a part of my life, and certainly once I'm done, I'm able to sort of reach out and do what I can, and so often, you know, there are people who, after I'm, you know, finished, I will certainly, if they're looking for work or need a recommendation, I'm glad to do that. I mean, in some ways, the very least I can do. So it's nice that, for me, it's one of the things I love about my work. It's kind of the perk, is that so many of the people become a part of my life and my family's life, and I feel so much richer for that.
And it's clear you keep in touch with people and develop these deep connections. I wanted to ask you also, just I'm so curious about your process. There are times I'm reading your work and I think, how did he do that, right? So talking about Eddie Bocanegra, you describe his teenage bedroom, right? The thickness and color of the carpet, the baseball players that are in posters on the wall versus the ones that are, you know, framed baseball cards. I mean, this is 30 years ago. How do you get that detail?
Well, it's thankfully I have somebody like Eddie who's got a really good memory, but it's, and you know, I teach at Northwestern, so I tell my students all this all the time, is you kind of interview, the way I think about it is kind of interview cinematically. In other words, it's, I don't literally do this, but if I was talking to somebody like Eddie about his, I want to be able to close my eyes and imagine that I'm in that attic with him. And so it's really, you know, people are not naturally gifted storytellers, so it's just asking these questions in some ways you got no business asking. And I've had people, Eddie wasn't one of them, but I've had people say, you know, why do you care about that? Why do you want to know that? And so I'm sure people get tired of me because I can be relentless with my questions. I can ask the same question over again sometimes. And with Eddie, it was a process of trying to get him to remember that room and help me feel like I was there with him so that readers will be there too.
So when you're writing, go ahead.
No, so it's just, it is this kind of, I mean, I do feel like when we read, you know, we tend not to remember ideas as much as remember moments or scenes or images. And so that's what I'm after, is to write with this kind of cinematic quality.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that helps make the story stick, right, in the mind. That's why you seek these details when you're telling these stories. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's what people remember, you know. And when done well, you know, because we've all had this experience, like when we've watched a movie or read a book, and then years later, that image, that moment has so stayed with you that you can't sort out whether it was something you'd actually experienced or whether you had, you know, seen it on the screen or read it in a book. And that's the power of story. Stories that especially have that cinematic quality to it.
So I think you've become one of the great chroniclers of Chicago and its people. You've written about and you continue to write about other people and other places too. And I've heard you say you don't want to be typecast, but I wonder, I mean, you started at the Wall Street Journal. For you, why did Chicago become so central to your work?
Yeah. So I'm a kind of accidental Chicagoan. I'm from New York originally. I've been here now for 35 years and it's home. But you know, I fell in love with this place. I love it, I think, for all the reasons you can imagine. I mean, it is really America's city. You can find all the fissures within the American landscape within the confines of the city, and you can find all that there is to celebrate about this country within the confines of this city. And I love the place for all its messy vitality. So I feel really fortunate to have landed here. And I write, I think, out of a fundamental sense that life ought to be fair. And so I find myself in corners of Chicago and corners of this country where life clearly isn't fair. And so that's sort of what keeps me going. But I love the city. I mean, I have a book, you know, Never a City So Real, which is, my wife calls my happy book, which is a celebration of people in the city, you know.
Yeah.
Of all these outsiders.
Well, one last question. Since most of our listeners on this program are not in Chicago, but gun violence is a problem throughout Illinois, whether you're in Springfield or Peoria or Rockford or even smaller towns, are there lessons or stories you hope everyone can take away from this book, even if they don't have a personal connection to Chicago?
You know, for me, this is very much a book about the soul of our country. And you know, it's interesting, you know, after the kind of the tragic mass shootings at Newtown and Parkland, you know, we asked all the right questions. You know, how what would bring a young man to do such a horrific act? What can we do to prevent it? How do people move on? How does the community move on with all this bearing down on them? We don't ask those questions in people that I write about in Chicago or Baltimore or New Orleans or Rockford or Peoria. This is not a problem that's unique to Chicago. And so it speaks very much to sort of how disconnected we are in this country. It's the sort of great paradox of this nation, I think, that we are a country of such generosity beside such neglect. And so my hope is that people will read this book and sort of begin to ask themselves, why aren't we asking those questions? We need to be asking those questions.
Alex Kotlowitz's latest book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. Alex, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Brian, thanks. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Since the pandemic and subsequent stay-at-home orders, many of us have been enjoying the endless amounts of movies and TV shows available for streaming online. Especially now, it seems that the days of going to a video store and physically renting a DVD or, for the dinosaurs among us, a VHS cassette, those days are long gone. That's a blast from the past for most of us. But according to an article in Vice from May, the last remaining Blockbuster location still survives, even amid a global pandemic. The general manager told Vice the store outlasted its DVD supplier, so she now buys them herself, stocking up at Walmart, Target, and the local grocery store. But here in Illinois, there are multiple surviving video rental shops and memories of some great ones that closed not too long ago. Today, we wanted to revisit a conversation I had on the show last year about some of the last remaining video stores. I was joined by two Jeffs, Jeff Pakenham, the manager of a couple family video locations in Springfield, and Jeff Merritt, the former owner of a longtime independently owned video store in Champaign-Urbana called That's Rentertainment. Jeff and Jeff, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Brian.
So, Jeff Pakenham, as I mentioned, there's this conception that tumbleweeds are rolling through the sites where all the video stores used to be, but there are, what, five family videos in the Springfield area alone? How many stores do you guys have across the country and in Illinois?
Currently in Illinois right now, we have 99 stores throughout the state of Illinois, and there are 664 throughout the United States and Canada.
Wow. So, you know, nowadays so many of us have access to Hulu and Netflix, things like that. Has patronage been consistent over the past decade, or have you seen a drop even at family video?
There has been a slight drop, you know, with the advent of Netflix and Hulu and other streaming services that they offer. Seems like almost every network nowadays has their own streaming service. But with that, though, throughout the Midwest, especially in the rural areas where streaming isn't really an option for them, they have, you know, low internet speeds and stuff like that, so that's not really an option for them. Family video is still thriving really well. Like, I'm actually, part of my job is I do checklists and visits at other stores. I'm actually in Clinton, Illinois today, and, you know, the small town of Clinton compared to bigger cities, Chicago, St. Louis, other big cities that we're in, it's thriving. We have a lot of options that they don't offer on the streaming services, so we still see a lot of heavy traffic, you know, especially those Friday, Saturday nights. We get the families in here. We have stuff for everybody.
Yeah, do you think there's something about the Midwest, why there are still video stores in the Midwest or in smaller towns as opposed to other areas?
With that, ever since I've been with Family Video going on 12 years now, and I've always, because I lived in California for a long time, we had the Blockbusters out there. Bigger cities and coastal cities, there's always just, you know, like a city in downtown New York, there's always just so much stuff that you could do 24 hours a day. Whether it's Canada or just through the Midwest, we have those lovely winters that come around, and there's not a lot to do. And so whether you're, you know, a family of one or a family of five or six, there's always stuff that you want to do on the weekends to entertain yourself. Some people can't go and afford to go see a movie nowadays, especially to keep raising the prices, and the popcorn is like $10 just for that, and the sodas and everything else, especially if you got mom, dad, and a couple of kids, versus they come to a video store on a Friday night and they pick out five or six movies, popcorn, candy, soda, and they're out the door for less than one ticket sometimes of what they would spend in the theater. But for the Midwest, I would just say it's just we were born here. We were born in Springfield, Illinois. That's where we come from. We started in Springfield, we just expanded outward. We just have that homegrown feel. It's a family-operated business.
Sure, sure. All right, Jeff Merritt, That's Rentertainment was open for 30 years. Did you specialize in any certain type of video?
We tried mostly to stock films that other people weren't stocking, so we had a huge selection of international films. We had classics. We had probably the biggest collection of anime films, at least in this area. So we specialized in subgenres that generally didn't show up in other video stores.
Yeah. So, I mean, heaven knows I did my part to support That's Rentertainment with an embarrassing amount of late fees in the late 1990s.
Thank you.
But you survived. You're welcome. You survived both format changes and changes in the way people watch movies for a long time. Why do you think you were so popular in the community?
I think it was because we were stocking things you couldn't get elsewhere. Being on the U of I campus, we made a point of keeping all the films that classes were using. So we were in contact with professors and students of film classes, just so every semester we'd know what was being used. So we'd make sure we had multiple copies of those things. We had all the new releases as well, but our business was primarily the smaller titles and the independent titles.
Yeah, I seem to remember it was the Warren Beatty movie Reds that led to one of my largest finds. That was a class assignment. Here is an example. We've got some tape of the adoration that people had for That's Rentertainment. This is former regular patron Benjamin Stone speaking on WILL in 2015 about his then-girlfriend, Sarah.
We would go in and rent one film and then decide we're going to go over to another section and find something we never would have seen before. And this became such an important place to us that when we were in the international section one day, I pulled the ring out of my pocket, knelt down, and proposed to Sarah in Rentertainment.
So what about you, Jeff Pakenham? You've been at, as you said, Family Video for 12 years. Who is coming to rent videos there? Can you tell us about your customers?
Our customers, they vary. They're everybody from the younger kids all the way up to grandma and grandpa. I've actually hired several people who started off coming to Family Video with their parents and renting kid movies and getting video games. And then as they've gotten older, went through high school and they're going through college, now they want to work at Family Video. Our average is just, if I could summarize it, probably is middle-class America. They come in here, they just want to rent a movie, stuff that, you know, you can't find on the streaming services or even in a red box. They come into our stores, and one of the best things about Family Video that I've always enjoyed, it is really like a family atmosphere. You come in, you're greeted, almost everybody knows everybody by name. We know what you like, what you don't like. So with everybody coming to Family Video so often, it's a plethora. I have customers I only see during the week. I have customers I only see on the weekends, families and stuff like that. But, you know, they're in there every single weekend or they're in there every single day. But I would say middle-class America, they come into Family Video. They like that brick-and-mortar feel. They like going in. They like reading about the movies they're going to rent. They like looking around. They like suggestions of the staff. Or they can bump into just another customer who go, hey, have you seen this movie? This guy or this girl? They were in this movie, and it was great. So you have that feeling when you come to a Family Video that it's family. You can, whether it's an employee or just a fellow customer, you just feel at home and it's comfortable.
Jeff Merritt, I wonder, did Ben Stone's story stand out to you? Were there multiple proposals in Rentertainment over the years?
Ben's was the only proposal I can remember over the years, and I'm still in touch with Ben. In fact, he's got the International Film Section sign that he proposed under. I gave that to him after we closed. We had a few of our employees ended up getting married to each other. A few of our employees ended up marrying customers, and I imagine at least a few sets of customers met in the store and hopefully are still happy elsewhere.
So we asked our listeners on Facebook and Twitter where and why they go to the video store. One commenter on Twitter says, "My wife and I just wanted to rent A Quiet Place. No streaming service we use had it for rent, only purchase. The Family Video had it." And just a reminder, if you want to join us, the number is 1-800-222-9455. Jeff Merritt, you closed That's Rentertainment in 2015. If you think about the fact that Netflix launched in 1998, TiVo the year after that, there's a way of looking at it where it's remarkable the store was able to keep going as long as it did. How do you see it?
Well, I think we kept going because in the early days of streaming, the content was very limited. It's still somewhat limited. But with the additional services that have come up, Criterion just announced that they're going to run their own streaming channel. And that's after Filmstruck just announced that they shut down.
R.I.P. Yes.
So the services are doing a better job of bringing the films that we used to be the only place one could get those films. But even so, if you look at the quantity of films that, say, Netflix has, we closed with 44,000 titles, and none of the streaming services have that many things. So if you want to see a mass of titles to flip through, I think you still have to go to one of the remaining video stores or a library to see that kind of quantity.
Yeah, we got an email from Hazel in Compton who said, "We loved Family Video. The store in Mendota closed recently, and it has crushed us. We are rural and deal with low internet speed, but more so, we limit our kids' screen time. Family Video gave us incredible control over what we watched." Jeff Merritt, how did your customers react when That's for Entertainment closed?
I think it was a bit of a surprise overall. We had an outpouring of very nice messages from longtime customers and former customers. It was heart-wrenching on many, many levels.
Yeah. Jeff Pakenham, who do you consider, or what do you consider the competition at Family Video? Is it streaming services, Redbox?
It actually depends on what city you're in. For the most part, the most similar type of competition that we have to our format, our model, brick and mortar, is Redbox. They're the ones. They're the physical disc that you can go and get and put in your actual DVD or Blu-ray player. So that's the most direct competition, I would say. Streaming, it varies. In the more rural areas where, you know, internet's not even an option for them to even have, that's really not a worry to us, because for those customers, we get them in all the time in our stores. They're going to come in. They're going to rent movies. But the most direct, similar kind of competition that we have is going to be the Redbox ones. But with that, though, with Redbox, they have such a limited selection on items. They may have the new movies that are out, but we have we have thousands and thousands of movies, classic movies, Indiana Jones, Uncle Buck, all these classics that people love to watch over and over again. Every Halloween and Christmas, we have holiday-themed sections that you can't go to a Redbox and rent. Some of those titles possibly could be on a streaming service, but if you live in an area where just streaming movies isn't an option, or even if you have internet, maybe the buffering just gets old after a while. You're trying to watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and you can't watch it because it's buffering so long, and a 90-minute movie takes over 2 hours to watch with all the glitches. So I would say our most direct competition is going to be Redbox, but we just blow them out of the water with our selection. We have thousands and thousands of movies that they just aren't capable of carrying.
All right, last question. Jeff Merritt, you continue to own Parasol Records in Urbana. I think some people could say you're a glutton for punishment, going from video stores and continuing to own a record store in 2019. What can people find there, even though we have about a minute left, but what can people find there, and are there some of the same challenges that you faced with the video store?
There are a lot of the same challenges, and we are constantly trying to reinvent ourselves. But we started as a mail order for independently produced pop music, and we continue to do that. We also run our own record labels, and that's gone a little on the wayside because it's so easy to put out all your own things via streaming.
Okay. I want to thank you. That is all the time we have for today. To Jeff Merritt, who shuttered That's for Entertainment, continues to run Parasol Records in Urbana, and Jeff Pakenham, who's manager of several Family Video locations in Springfield. Jeff, thank you both for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Brian.
Coming up on Monday's show, we're going to revisit my conversation with Professor Alvin Tillery. He joined me earlier this month after the widespread protests over the police killing of George Floyd to put them in some historical perspective and context. And that is all the time we have for this week. Before we go, I do want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. Just this very week, we heard from listeners about some favorite, safe, pandemic-friendly getaway spots, road trips one can take during the summer. That was on Tuesday's program. And on Wednesday, we heard from some listeners via text about whether kids should go back to school or should not go back to school this fall. You can join our texting group, text the 21st. Just send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. If you want to listen to those segments I just mentioned about schools, kids going back to school, or about summer road trips, you can find that and all our other recent segments on our podcast feeds. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Today's encore segments were originally produced by Alan Montecilio and Robin Lynn. Now our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpesson's our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey, and we'll talk to you next week.